A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know that feeling when someone says, well, I guess it's a short trip, and you can hear the accusation hiding inside the statement, but if you call it out, they say you're imagining things.
Oh, I know that feeling. The words are technically neutral, but the subtext is screaming. And the worst part is, you can't prove any of it.
That's the trap. So we have a special prompt today from a listener named Tim Shortnap, and he's living in that exact dynamic. He's dealing with a relative who counts visit days like a forensic accountant, probes for competing trip lengths to use as ammunition, and when confronted, retreats to, you're imagining what I'm asking. Then there's the parent who modeled this behavior growing up, the specific tone of voice that conveys disapproval, followed by withdrawing a favor, followed by pretending there's no connection between the two things. Tim's question is basically, how do you engage with this kind of person without losing your mind?
The thing is, Tim's not asking how to fix the relative. He's asking how to preserve his own sanity. That's the right question. Because passive aggression isn't just annoying, it's a learned control strategy. The Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley has work on this. It stems from a fear of direct conflict combined with a need to express anger. The person wants you to know they're upset without having to own it.
They get to deliver the attack and maintain plausible deniability at the same time. It's the emotional equivalent of throwing a rock and hiding your hand.
That plausible deniability is what makes it so maddening. Psychology Today defines passive aggression as a pattern of indirectly expressing negative feelings instead of openly addressing them. The key feature is that the person can always retreat to, you're overreacting, or I was just asking. And here's the part that really gets me. They often genuinely believe they're being reasonable.
That's the self-deception layer. They've constructed an internal narrative where they're just stating facts or just making an observation. When are you visiting the other relative? In their head, that's a neutral question. They're not consciously thinking, I'm gathering data to compute a grievance.
That's what makes it so disorienting for the target. If someone yells at you, you know what happened. Your nervous system registers the threat, you can name it, you can respond to it. But when someone uses a weaponized tone and then denies it, you're stuck in this cognitive dissonance loop. Your gut says, I'm being attacked, but the words say nothing is happening, and you start doubting your own perception.
That's by design, even if the design isn't fully conscious. The Greater Good piece notes that passive aggression exploits social norms of politeness. You're supposed to take people at their word. You're supposed to assume good intent. So when someone violates that contract by smuggling hostility into polite language, you're caught between two social rules. The rule that says, don't accuse people unfairly, and the rule that says, trust your instincts.
It's a perfect trap. And Tim's situation illustrates it beautifully, if beautifully is the right word for something this frustrating. The relative who counts visit days, the parent who uses that flat, cold, well, that's your decision tone, then withdraws a promised ride and acts like the two things are unrelated. These are classic moves.
Let's sit with that. Well, that's your decision line for a second. On the surface, it's an acknowledgement of autonomy. It sounds almost respectful, but the tone transforms it into, I don't approve, and I'm going to convey my displeasure by making you feel the chill. Then the favor gets withdrawn, and if you connect the dots out loud, they act like you're paranoid.
If you grew up with this, your whole calibration is off. Research on family systems shows that passive-aggressive patterns are often intergenerational. Children of passive-aggressive parents learn that love is conditional, and that displeasure is communicated through withdrawal, not words. So you become hypervigilant. You learn to scan for micro-shifts in tone, for the slight pause before a sentence, for the way someone says, fine, instead of, okay. You become a translator of indirect communication, and that's exhausting.
It's a survival adaptation in childhood that becomes a liability in adulthood. You're decoding subtext that other people don't even know they're sending. And Tim mentioned something really specific, he said. I'm not under the control of this parent, but it's something I've still encountered when communicating with them by phone and find incredibly frustrating and stressful. So even when the power dynamic is gone, even when you're an independent adult with your own life, the pattern still gets under your skin.
Because the pattern was installed before you had defenses. It's like a piece of code that runs at the operating system level. You can't reason your way out of the emotional response because the emotional response was wired in before you had reasoning skills. That's not weakness. That's neurology.
We're dealing with a tactic that has three signature moves. 1. The weaponized tone, a specific vocal quality that communicates disapproval without any words you can point to. 2. The factual probe, asking about the other relative's visit length, pretending it's neutral curiosity when it's actually surveillance. 3. The withdrawn favor, offering help, then rescinding it when displeased, while denying any connection. And all three are protected by the same shield. You're imagining things.
That shield is nearly impenetrable if you try to attack it directly. If you say you're being passive-aggressive, they will deny it. If you say you're punishing me for visiting the other relative longer, they will say, I have no idea what you're talking about, I simply asked when you were going. And now, you're the aggressive one. Now you're the one picking a fight.
The entire game is rigged. You can't win by arguing about what they meant because they will always deny intent. And the more you push, the more unhinged you look. Meanwhile, they get to sit there calm and wounded, saying, I don't know why you're so upset.
Which brings us to the core question Tim is really asking. Not, how do I make this person stop, but how do I engage without losing my sanity? And the answer starts with a shift in framing. You have to stop trying to prove they're being unfair and start focusing on what you can control, which is your own response.
That's the pivot point. The moment you accept that you will never get them to admit what they're doing, you're free. You're not playing their game anymore. You're playing your own.
Your game has different rules. The goal isn't to win an argument about subtext. The goal is to protect your peace. That's what we're going to dig into. What actually works, what scripts you can use, and how to stop feeding the cycle.
Let's get specific about what this looks like in real life. Because the devil is in the details, the tone, the timing, the exact words they choose, and the exact words you can choose back.
I think the first thing to nail down is why this feels worse than someone just yelling at you. Someone screams, I'm angry about the visit schedule, you know where you stand. It's unpleasant, but it's legible. Passive aggression is illegible by design.
Illegible is exactly the word. You're squinting at a sentence trying to figure out if it's a threat or a weather report. And the person who wrote it is standing there saying, it's just a weather report. Why are you so tense?
Psychology. Today's definition really captures this. They call it a pattern of indirectly expressing negative feelings instead of openly addressing them. The key feature is plausible deniability. The person wants you to know they're upset without having to own it. So they build a message with two layers, the surface layer that's technically innocent, and the subtext layer that carries the attack.
If you respond to the subtext, they retreat to the surface layer and make you look unreasonable. It's a rhetorical bunker. They can fire out, but you can't fire in.
Here's where it gets psychologically interesting. The Greater Good Science Center points out that this often isn't a fully conscious strategy. Passive-aggressive people frequently believe their own cover story. When the relative asks, when are you visiting the other relative, in their internal narrative, they're just making conversation. The aggression is real, but the awareness of it is partial or absent.
Which is why calling them out directly almost never works. You're accusing them of something they've already convinced themselves they're not doing, so of course they deny it. And their denial feels genuine to them, which makes your accusation feel even more unfair.
That's the sanity-eroding mechanism Tim is describing. When someone denies something you clearly perceived, you start doubting your own reality. Am I being too sensitive? Am I reading into things? Maybe they really were just asking a neutral question. The self-doubt is the point. It's not a bug in the tactic, it's the feature.
It's gaslighting, but the kind where the gaslighter might not even know they're holding the match. The effect on the target is identical. Cognitive dissonance, self-doubt, the exhaustion of constantly translating between what was said and what was meant.
Compare that to outright hostility. If someone says, I'm furious you're visiting them longer than me, you can engage with that. You can explain the ticket situation. You can apologize. You can set a boundary. The conflict is out in the open where it can be resolved or at least named. Passive aggression short-circuits all of that. The conflict exists, but it's denied entry into the conversation.
It's like trying to wrestle smoke. You can feel it, you can see it, but you can't get a grip on it. And the effort of trying exhausts you long before you make any progress.
There's another layer too, which the greater good work touches on. Passive aggression exploits the social norms of politeness. We're all trained to take people at their word, to assume good faith, to not accuse others of hidden motives. These are good norms. They make society function. But a passive-aggressive person weaponizes them. They use your own civility against you.
Because you're the one who'll look rude if you push. You're the one who'll seem paranoid if you say, "I think you're actually angry about the visit length." They get to stay in the safe zone of plausible deniability while you have to choose between swallowing the attack or looking like the aggressor.
That's why Tim's frustration is so visceral. He can tell exactly what the other person is doing. He's not confused about the dynamic. He sees it clearly. But seeing it clearly doesn't help when the other person's entire strategy is to deny that what you're seeing exists. Clarity without recourse is its own kind of torment.
You're not crazy. You're just disarmed. You have perfect radar and no weapons.
Let's map the three signature moves Tim described, because each one works on a different psychological lever. The first is the weaponized tone. This is the one that's hardest to prove and easiest to deny, because it's not about words at all. It's a specific vocal quality, flat, cold, clipped. Well, that's your decision.
The content is technically an acknowledgement of autonomy, but the delivery transforms it into a verdict. You can hear the disapproval in the space between the words, the pause before decision, the slight drop in pitch, the absence of warmth that was there a moment ago.
What makes this so effective is that humans are exquisitely sensitive to tone. We evolved to read emotional signals from voice before we had language. So your nervous system registers the threat instantly, but your conscious mind can't point to anything concrete. You just know something shifted. And when you try to describe it, you sound unhinged. She said it was my decision, but the way she said it...
You sound like you're litigating vowel sounds, which is exactly where they want you. The second move Tim mentioned is the factual probe. When are you visiting the other relative? On its face, a neutral question about logistics. In reality, it's surveillance.
Here's the tell. The question is never asked once. Tim said the relative probes repeatedly. That's how you know it's not curiosity. Curiosity gets satisfied. Surveillance needs constant updates. The relative is building a spreadsheet in their head, and every answer is a new data point for the grievance column.
The probe also has a secondary function. It puts you on notice. The moment you're asked, you know you're being monitored. You know the comparison is coming. So even if you answer neutrally, the seed is planted. You're now thinking about the visit length discrepancy from their perspective, trying to pre-defend a decision that wasn't a decision in the first place. It was just the ticket you could find.
That's the insidious part. The probe doesn't just gather ammunition, it shifts the burden. Suddenly, you're the one doing emotional labor to justify a perfectly neutral set of facts. And the third move completes the cycle, the withdrawn favor. The parent offers a ride, then something displeases them, then the ride disappears, and the two events are treated as completely unrelated.
Tim described this with surgical precision. The parent says, "Well, that's your decision," in that tone, then later can't give the ride, and if you connect the dots, they act like you're seeing battens in static. The denial is the keystone that holds the whole arch together.
This is where the Psychology Today research gets really clarifying. Passive-aggressive people often believe they're being reasonable. Their internal narrative isn't, "I'm punishing my child by withdrawing a favor." It's, "I offered a ride, and now I can't give it." These things happen. The self-deception isn't an act, it's a psychological defense mechanism. They can't face their own indirect hostility, so they edit it out of their conscious awareness.
Which means when you confront them, you're not breaking through a lie. You're trying to break through a reality they've constructed. And that's almost impossible, because they're not pretending to believe it. They actually do believe it. Their denial is sincere, even though it's false.
For the person on the receiving end, that sincere denial is devastating, because now you're not just dealing with hostility, you're dealing with hostility that comes wrapped in a claim that you're the one with the problem, you're too sensitive. You're reading into things. You're imagining it. Tim used that exact word. You're imagining what I'm asking.
That's the phrase that does the most damage. It doesn't just deny the accusation. It denies your competence as a perceiver. It says your basic ability to interpret social reality is broken. And if you've heard that enough times, especially growing up, you start to believe it.
Which brings us to the childhood training ground. Research on family systems shows these patterns are intergenerational. A child of a passive-aggressive parent learns a very specific lesson. Love is conditional, and displeasure is communicated through withdrawal, not words. You don't get told, "I'm angry." You get the cold tone. You get the favor that evaporates. You get the silence that stretches just a beat too long.
You learn to be a translator. You become hypervigilant to micro-shifts in tone because your emotional safety depends on detecting displeasure early. You over-apologize because you've learned that the fastest way to restore equilibrium is to take responsibility for the tension, even when you didn't cause it. You over-explain your decisions because you're preemptively defending against accusations that haven't been made yet.
Tim mentioned he's no longer under this parent's control, but the pattern still gets to him over the phone. That's the intergenerational wiring. The dynamic was installed in childhood when the parent had real power. Now, as an adult, the power is gone, but the emotional circuitry is still there. The tone still triggers the same alarm system. The probe still activates the same urge to justify and explain.
That's not a personal failure. That's conditioning. If you ring a bell before feeding a dog enough times, the dog salivates at the bell even when there's no food. If a parent pairs displeasure with withdrawal enough times during your formative years, you feel that same cold dread at the tone even when you're 40 and live in a different country.
The clinical term would be a conditioned emotional response. And the frustrating part is that knowing it's conditioned doesn't make it stop. You can't think your way out of a response that was wired in before your prefrontal cortex was fully online.
The trap is fully set. You've got three tactics: the tone, the probe, the withdrawn favor. Each one is deniable. Each one triggers a deeply wired response, and the person deploying them will deny intent until the end of time. If your strategy is to get them to admit what they're doing, you will lose every single time, because the game is designed to make that impossible.
That's the trap Tim needs to see clearly before any strategy can work. You cannot win by arguing about what they meant. The conversation about intent is a black hole. It will absorb all your energy and give nothing back. The only way out is to stop trying to prove the subtext exists and start responding exclusively to the surface text, while protecting your own boundaries underneath.
That's the pivot. You stop being a detective and start being a wall. But we'll get to the how of that next.
First, I just want to name one more thing about why the withdrawn favor is especially toxic. It's not just about losing the ride. It's about the message, your choices have consequences, but I'm not going to tell you what those consequences are or when they'll arrive. The punishment is unpredictable and unacknowledged. That's a control mechanism designed to make you preemptively comply, to avoid displeasing the person because you never know what favor might quietly vanish next.
It trains you to self-censor. You start making decisions based not on what you want, but on what won't trigger the invisible penalty system. And the person running the system never has to own that they're running it. They get the compliance without ever making an explicit demand.
Which is why Tim's question about sanity is so sharp. The sanity cost isn't just the frustration in the moment. It's the cumulative effect of living inside someone else's unspoken rulebook, constantly scanning for violations you didn't know existed, and being told you're imagining things. Let's get practical. Four strategies, and each one comes with something you can actually say. The first is, name the pattern, not the intent. If you say you're being passive-aggressive, you've just triggered the denial reflex. Instead, you describe what you observed and ask a question. I notice you asked about the visit length twice. Is there something specific you're worried about?
That's clean. You're not accusing, you're observing and inviting. If there's a real concern, it might actually surface. And if there isn't, the question just hangs there, and they have to either drop it or admit they're keeping score.
You've shifted from, "I'm on to you," to, "I'm paying attention." It's less confrontational, but more disarming. The probe loses its camouflage.
Strategy 2 is where the greater good piece gets really useful. Passive aggression works because it gets a reaction. You get flustered, defensive, you start over-explaining the ticket situation. That reaction is the payoff, so you starve it.
Calm, boring neutrality. The relative says, "Well, I guess it's a short trip. You say, "It is short. We're excited to see you for the time we have." You acknowledge the fact, you ignore the subtext, you redirect to positive. The probe gets zero purchase.
That's the key. You're not pretending you didn't hear the subtext. You heard it. You're just declining to engage with it. You're responding to the words as if they were spoken in good faith, which starves the hostility of oxygen.
It's almost elegant in its simplicity. They wanted you to squirm, and you didn't. They wanted you to justify, and you didn't. You just agreed with the surface fact and moved on. What are they going to do? Say, "No, I meant it as an attack."
Strategy 3 addresses the favor withdrawal directly. If you have a parent with a history of offering help and then pulling it when displeased, you preempt the dynamic. "I'd love a ride, but only if you're sure. If anything changes, just let me know by Thursday so I can make other plans."
That's boundary setting without accusation. You're not saying, "I know you'll probably cancel." You're saying, "I'm making contingency plans because that's what responsible adults do." You've removed the unspoken leverage. The favor can no longer be withdrawn as punishment because you've already built the exit ramp.
The Thursday deadline is specific. It's not, "Let me know at some point." It's, "Let me know by Thursday." You're defining the terms of engagement without making it personal.
Strategy 4 is the one for when they inevitably deny everything. You're imagining things. You're reading into it. This is where most people get sucked into the argument about what they meant. Use the broken record.
"Maybe I am, but I'm still going to make my own plans for transportation. You don't need them to admit intent. You only need to protect your own peace." That sentence does both. It declines the argument and restates the boundary.
Notice what you're not doing. You're not defending your perception. You're not trying to prove the subtext existed. You're not litigating tone. You're saying, "Your denial is noted and my boundary stands regardless." The two things are not connected.
That's the through line across all four strategies. The goal is not to win, not to get them to change, not to extract an apology. The goal is to stop participating in the game. You're not a mind reader, and you're not responsible for managing someone else's indirect anger.
Here's the thing Tim might find freeing. Once you stop trying to decode the subtext and just respond to the surface, the dynamic shifts. They can still be passive-aggressive, but it stops working on you. The weapon is still there, but it's firing blanks.
How do you actually hold on to all of this in the moment? When someone hits you with that tone and your nervous system lights up? Because knowing the strategies intellectually and deploying them in real time are two different things.
That's exactly the problem. When the probe comes, your threat response fires faster than your reasoning. You need a mental checklist that's simple enough to remember under stress.
Walk me through them.
Step 1. Is this about me or about their unexpressed feelings? 9 times out of 10, the passive-aggressive comment has almost nothing to do with you. It's about their anxiety, their jealousy, their need for control. The visit-length probe isn't really about the visit. It's about their fear of being less important. Asking yourself this question in the moment creates a split second of distance. You stop taking the bait personally.
That reframe alone is worth the price of admission. You're not the cause of their feeling. You're just the nearest target.
Do I need to respond to the subtext or just the surface text? The answer is almost always just the surface. When are you visiting the other relative? The surface text is a logistical question. Answer the logistics. We're still figuring out dates. You don't owe them the emotional translation work.
Step 3. What is the minimum dignified response that protects my boundary? Minimum dignified response. Not the response that proves your innocence. Not the response that makes them feel better. Not the response that wins the argument. The minimum thing you can say that maintains your self-respect and doesn't hand them any ammunition.
That phrase, minimum dignified response, is worth writing down somewhere. Because the urge in these situations is to over-explain. You want to lay out the ticket prices, the work schedule, the flight availability, the whole spreadsheet. You want to prove that the visit length discrepancy isn't a preference, and that over-explanation is exactly what the passive-aggressive person feeds on. You've just handed them a buffet of details to pick apart.
Over-explaining is a tell. It signals that you feel guilty, even when you've done nothing wrong. And guilt is what they're trying to manufacture. The moment you start justifying, you've accepted the premise that your decision needs justification.
For listeners who grew up with this pattern, that urge to overexplain is practically hardwired. You learned as a child that if you could just explain your choice clearly enough, the disapproval would lift. but it never did because the disapproval wasn't about your explanation. It was about your non-compliance. The explanation was never the solution, it was just more material for the machine.
That's the part Tim needs to hear, I think. He said he's not under his parents' control anymore, but the pattern still stresses him out over the phone. That's because the survival strategy he developed as a kid, the hypervigilance, the translating, the over-explaining is still running. It's a program that outlived its purpose.
Here's the permission slip. You are allowed to stop translating. You are allowed to stop being the person who decodes everyone's indirect communication. That skill kept you safe when you were dependent on someone who expressed displeasure through withdrawal. You're not dependent anymore. You don't need to read the tone. You can just take the words at face value and let the subtext float away unanswered.
It feels cold at first. It feels like you're being deliberately obtuse, but what you're actually doing is refusing to participate in a communication style that was designed to make you anxious. That's not coldness, that's self-preservation.
There's something liberating on the other side of it. When you stop trying to prove you're being treated unfairly, you reclaim all the energy you were spending on the case. The case was never going to be won anyway. There's no courtroom where passive-aggressive relatives are convicted of tone crimes. The only verdict that matters is whether you let it ruin your afternoon.
You cannot control whether someone is passive-aggressive. You can control whether you played a game. The moment you stop trying to prove they're being unfair, you reclaim your energy. That's the whole thing in one sentence.
The game loses its appeal for them when it stops working. Not immediately, and not always, but over time. A passive-aggressive tactic that produces no reaction is a tool with no function. They may escalate briefly, they may try a different angle, but eventually the behavior either adapts or it just becomes background noise you've trained yourself to ignore.
Even if it doesn't change them at all, it changes you. You go from being someone who gets hijacked by other people's indirect hostility to someone who notices it, names it internally, and chooses not to engage. That's a form of freedom, even if the relative never acknowledges a thing.
I think Tim's question points to something worth sitting with for a moment. What happens when you apply these strategies consistently over months? Does the passive-aggressive person escalate, or do they eventually learn that the tactic no longer works?
My guess is both, in sequence. There's usually an extinction burst first. The behavior gets worse before it gets better, because the person is used to the old response, and they're trying to get it back. The tone gets colder, the probes get sharper, the favors get withdrawn more dramatically.
That tracks with what we know about behavioral extinction. When a reinforced behavior stops producing the expected payoff, the organism doesn't just shrug and move on, it tries harder. The passive-aggressive relative who used to get a flustered justification from you will escalate when you start responding with calm neutrality. They'll think the dose wasn't high enough.
That's the danger zone, because the escalation feels like proof that the strategy isn't working. You try the new approach, things get worse, and your instinct is to retreat to the old pattern. But the escalation is actually a sign that the strategy is working. The old game isn't producing the old payoff, and they're frustrated.
If you can ride out the extinction burst without re-engaging, something interesting can happen on the other side. The behavior either fades because it's no longer functional, or becomes so transparently absurd that it loses its emotional power over you. Either way, you win.
Even if it never fades, even if the relative spends the next 20 years probing and tone policing and withdrawing favors, the internal shift is what matters. You stop being someone who gets hijacked by it. It becomes weather. Annoying weather, but weather.
Which brings us to the closing thought. The sanest response to passive aggression is not to decode it. It's to decline the invitation to decode it. You are not a mind reader, and you are not responsible for managing someone else's indirect anger.
That's the permission Tim needs. And honestly, it's the permission a lot of people need. You can just take the words at face value and let the subtext float away unanswered. That's not naivete. That's refusing a game you never agreed to play.
Thanks to Tim Shortnap for sending in this prompt. It's the kind of question that probably helped a lot of people listening, whether they'd admit it or not.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you have a question that's been eating at you, send it to show@myweirdprompts.com. We're back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.